corresponding to the 29th of May 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar and 21st of October 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For blessing this moment, let's listen to verse 13 of chapter Al-Qasas. Then we'll come back to the studio and speak about the important point of this verse.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فرددناه إلى أمه كي تقر عينها ولا تحزن ولتعلم أن وعد الله حق ولتعلم أن وعد الله حق ولكن أكثرهم لا يعلمون.
So we restored him to his mother that she might be content and not grieve, and that she would know that the promise of Allah is true. But most of the people do not know.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Never do the divine promises fail, but the majority of people are those who see only the surface of the things and have no understanding of the wise secrets and advice plans of Allah. Of course, for the people of truth, the aims are important, not the titles. It is understood from the commentary that Moses remained in the castle of Pharaoh with utmost honor until the period of his puberty. But this theistic statement made Pharaoh very convenient, so much so that he decided to kill Moses.
Life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I? When I have you, to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness, everything which makes us sad, know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong. A world that often lies, as I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you know I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
And the topic of discussion for today is nomophobia, means the fear of being without your phone. This study revealed that this fear can be so powerful that many people never turn off their phones, even at night or during times that they won't be using their devices. When asked why they never turn off their phones, 55 cited a need to keep in touch with family and friends. 10% said they needed to be contactable for work reasons, and 9% reported that turning off their phones made them anxious. The fear of missing out on something is perhaps what leads so many people to report that they would respond to a call or text even they are in the middle of something else. This study revealed that people were often willing to interrupt life activities in order to respond to a call. The majority of people, 80%, were willing to answer a call while watching television. 40% would respond to a call while eating a meal. And 18% would be willing to answer the phone when they were in bed.
The mere thought of being without your phone, or, heaven forbid, losing your connectivity, can trigger a wave of panic. It's like a safety blanket has been yanked away, leaving you exposed and vulnerable. You might worry about missing out on important news or not being able to respond to a message instantly. This anxiety can be overwhelming, sometimes even crippling. Then there's dependency. For some, the phone becomes a lifeline, a source of validation, entertainment, and social interaction. Without it, you feel lost, disconnected from the world. You might find yourself reaching for your phone first thing in the morning, before you've even had a chance to rub the sleep from your eyes. It's the last thing you see at night, and the first thing you greet in the morning. This heavy reliance on a device is a clear sign of nomophobia. Finally, there's avoidance of separation. Individuals with nomophobia might go to great lengths to ensure their phones are always within reach. They'll avoid situations where they might be without their device, making sure they always have a charging cable handy, or taking their phone with them even when they step into the next room. Recognizing these symptoms is the first step towards addressing nomophobia. It's about understanding that while smartphones are an integral part of our lives, they should not control us. We are more than our devices, and it's crucial to maintain a healthy balance. Why do people experience nomophobia? What are the underlying causes? Our modern world is dominated by digital technology, and smartphones are at the forefront of this revolution. They've become our personal assistants, entertainment hubs, and social connectors, making them an integral part of our everyday lives. This heavy reliance on smartphones for almost everything, from communication to navigation, has made us more susceptible to nomophobia.
IRIB English Radio presents today's special, Every Day for 15 Minutes. Today's special. Now let's look at a way to reduce phone separation anxiety. Schedule more time with family and friends in person. Another method is to find ways to connect directly to people unrelated to texting or emailing. Instead, try scheduling more time in person with friends and family. In feeling more separate and independent from your phone, you can reduce the worries of being without a smartphone and perhaps even discover a sense of relief or joy from not being tied to it all the time. This is today's special. If you have symptoms of nomophobia, or if you feel like your mobile phone use is causing problems in your life, talking to a mental health professional can help. While there is no specific treatment for nomophobia, your therapist may recommend exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or both to address your symptoms. In some instances, your doctor may also prescribe some type of medication to address symptoms of anxiety or depression that you might be experiencing.
Nomophobia has become one of the newest phobias in today's world. Majority of people depend on their phone for multiple reasons, such as communications, information, etc. Business and corporations are requiring employees to leave their communication devices, especially smartphones, outside the meeting room, due to the fact that it creates distraction. Not being able to use phones during meetings may work in some corporations and businesses. However, it may not work outside of those areas. being able to control a phobia is not an easy thing to do. People that have overcome their fears most of the time fail due to stress or anxiety. However, it is not impossible to do so. There is a model that helps control nomophobia, which is called the demand control person, which is a comprehensive theoretical framework for examining stress formations in individuals. Therefore, the model can be applied to a very stressful environment and situations. You don't have to apply this only when you're having a phobia, but also when, let's say, you're going to give a presentation, or if you're having other types of stress, like family stress, relationship stress, any other stress. This model can help reduce stress by providing a reason to use a smartphone at some point and not just use it because of social media. Some people like to use it just to check social media, but that's not the main thing for a smartphone. The main thing is to communicate to other people, to talk to other people, to text other people, not only to check social media or Instagram or whatever social media there is out there. In conclusion, nomophobia is one of the phobias that is increasing as technology advances and new generations are being brought into this world of technology. People may be unaware of this phobia as it is now. However, it is becoming a stress and anxiety condition for many of the new generation. It is becoming a problem not only for their family, but also for society. This could change as technology progresses. This will change. More people will have it at some point. More people will show nomophobia.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Till then, we leave you in Allah's mercy. Be a man.
You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. There's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me your hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land if I
day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day, where the words of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny shine a light on our daily lives. Today's episode unpacks a profound prophetic warning. The Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings be upon him, and his holy progeny said, "There are three things I fear for my nation: misguidance after knowledge, misleading temptations, and desires of the stomach and private parts." So let's take a few moments to reflect on each of these, because they're not abstract fears, they're real, they're here. First, misguidance after knowledge. This is the tragedy of someone who knows the truth but walks away from it. They've tasted guidance, they've understood right from wrong, and still they turn. And this can happen slowly, not overnight. One compromise here, one excuse there, and eventually the heart becomes numb. You see, the people after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, for example, they betrayed the message and the command of the Holy Prophet, and they forgot all things, all his commendations and commands about following Imam Ali alayhi salam. Even Lady Fatima tried to remind them, but they would intentionally forget about it. So it's not ignorance that's most dangerous, it's betrayal of the truth we already know. As Allah says in the Quran, "Do not be like those who forgot Allah, so He made them forget themselves." So when you know and ignore, the fall is deeper. So protect your light, nourish it. Don't let knowledge turn into pride or forgetfulness. The second fear the Holy Prophet has for the Muslim nation, the Islamic Ummah, is misleading temptations. These are trials that don't just test you, they confuse you. Today, we live in an age flooded with confusing fitan. I will tell you what fitna is. It's not just a challenge, it's something that makes falsehood look like truth, and truth look too hard. Voices pulling in every direction, some in the name of progress, some in the name of religion, and some in the name of freedom, in different names, but not all are grounded in truth. So what's the protection? Go back to Quran, hold to the Prophet's example, stay connected to people of sincere faith and insight, like Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and don't follow the crowd, follow the light, inshallah. And the third one is desires of the stomach and private parts. It might sound simple, but these are two of the most destructive desires. Greed for food or for consumption, for comfort, and unchecked lust. Inshallah, we would be immune to all of them, being aware all the time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم صل على
practitioners who do not just treat trauma, they confront its root causes. They move between clinics and protest lines, blending care with conviction. The work challenges systems, amplifies silenced voices, and redefines what it means to actually heal. My guest today is one such practitioner whose outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy and support for Palestinian resistance have sparked both admiration and controversy. Welcome to Saul. I am Bahman Arai. Jennifer Koonings is a psychiatric nurse practitioner and sexual assault forensic examiner based in New York City. She holds two Master of Science degrees and is certified in trauma-informed care, specializing in PTSD, anxiety, and depression. Her clinical work intersects with activism, particularly around Palestinian solidarity and anti-imperialist causes. In 2024, she joined the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, aiming to challenge the blockade on Gaza. Koonings has written for outlets like Common Dreams and Antiwar.com and gained attention for her hunger strike protesting the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Jennifer Koonings, very good to have you on this program.
It's great to be here.
How do you reconcile professional boundaries with personal convictions?
Yeah, I think as healthcare workers, and especially in the line of work that I'm now, it's best to always just be neutral and kind of like go off of whatever your patient is telling you and their experiences. So I kind of like shape however I approach my patients in that way. But, you know, my personal convictions of, you know, standing for the oppressed and fighting against injustice are always going to shape the ways that I approach my patients. And I think that it has allowed me to become a better clinician in the sense that I'm never going to blame my patient for like the circumstances that they're in. And more often than not, it's just the position that they're in is the result of their circumstances, and most especially just the extreme level of poverty that so many in America are suffering through.
And of course, talking about professional boundaries, you may have crossed some professional boundaries, but you never crossed ethical boundaries.
You know, are you referencing when I got fired?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, I actually don't think that I crossed any professional boundaries. I think I've always been very professional, you know, in my work. And, you know, I was actually in the job. I'll just explain, like, the job that I used to do. So I was a sexual assault forensic examiner, and it's the clinician that's called into the hospital whenever a patient comes in and says, I was sexually assaulted, I want a forensic exam. So I would go into the hospital and do the exam for them, collect the evidence, everything. And I had been doing it for many years. I think at that point, maybe 4 or 5 years at that point. And I was previously in Istanbul for the flotilla back in April. And then after that, you know, the whole mission got canceled because of the Zionists. And I had the opportunity to go to Palestine afterwards. And that's where I was. And that's when the New York District Attorney's Office started contacting me saying that one of my cases was going to trial and that I had to go and testify. And I I must have mentioned that I was in Palestine to that district attorney. And from that moment on, I realized that she was kind of like on a path to destroy my career. And that's kind of what she attempted to do. So she subpoenaed me from Palestine. I had to go back to New York and testify for, you know, and of course I was happy to go and fight, you know, I wanted to do anything that I could for the victim that I did the case to get justice.
Indeed.
And I went, and after that, and I testified, and after that, the hospital that I worked for started contacting me, and they told me actually that the District Attorney's Office of New York said that they would never use me as an expert witness again because I had lost all credibility because I started doing more content creation in December of 2023 after the New York Times story on the fake rape hoax. And I read that story, and I knew that I had to start speaking about it, because that's what I did for one of my jobs. You know, assess evidence, assess, you know, victims of crimes, sexual crimes specifically. So I started making videos about that and kind of offering my professional views or professional, I don't know, expertise on that. I never said, like, oh, these things never happened. All I said was, this evidence that the New York Times is presenting as fact would never stand in court. And the sources that they're pointing to are not, don't have any credibility or license to be able to make those kind of claims. I think that the New York Times was referencing like architects and dentists, and I'm not really, oh, like EMS, like an EMS worker. So that's all that I was saying, and the New York District Attorney's Office actually had an entire evidentiary hearing about me and my social media, and went through my social media to the court, and put me on public record as a rape apologist. So yeah, that's what she did to me.
Oh.
But so I knew that I did the right thing, you know.
The ethical lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about what motivated you to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla in 2024.
Yeah, I mean, that opportunity came to me maybe in like March or April of 2024. And it was something that I didn't even have to think twice about it. I was like, of course I want to go. You know, I was seeing images of mutilated children every day and feeling helpless and feeling like, what more can I do, especially as an American, when, you know, it's my tax dollars that are going to fund these bombs, that are going to fund this apartheid state. Just the immense guilt that I had, even though it's like, you know, I don't support it, it's still my government. So when that opportunity came, I jumped at it.
And how do you think, what do you think the impact of getting on with this whole Freedom Flotilla vessels idea is? Because it's always being stopped,
yeah,
and people are getting a little bit indifferent to them, and they're not covered the way they deserve to be. So how do you think is still the impact and worth of taking on some journeys?
You know, that's kind of something that I would hear a lot about, you know, a lot of things that I've done in my life, people making the excuse, oh, well, you're going to change anything, so why are you doing that? You're not going to be successful, you're not going to this, you're not going to that. And I think that perhaps when people say things like that, I have come to the conclusion that sometimes it's to make them feel more comfortable with their inaction. But also, just, I don't know, I think that's kind of the result of living, especially in the U.S., of making us as Americans feel like we're helpless, and take away our agency. So I kind of reject that, and even though we don't know what the outcome of really anything that we'd ever do in this life, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try.
Right. And can you describe the experience of preparing for it and participating in that Freedom Flotilla mission?
The preparation for that, I actually wrote my will, and I had to tell, you know, the people that I loved in my life that I was going to do that. I think that, I didn't think that it was like a huge risk that I was taking. You know, I didn't think that I would lose my life, but I did know that there is a possibility of that, considering what happened to the Mavi Marmara and how the Zionists killed 11 activists. In like when they did I think it was the third mission they did. So I knew it was a risk, and just, you know, seeing what the Zionist regime had been able to get away with complete impunity in front of the entire world for so long, we all know that there's basically nothing that they could do that anyone would ever hold them account for. So I think anyone standing up to them, you know that you're taking some risk in doing that, because look at what they're doing to the Palestinians day in, day out on the live stream.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what do did you hope to achieve? Kind of gets back to my first question.
You know, I think like we really hoped to break the siege, and the ship that I tried.
You really considered that a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, what? Who gives Israel the power to stop? You know, ships and activists, and there's a so-called Palestinian state. Where is the Palestinian state? People can't access Palestine unless they get approval from Israel. Like, what other context in the world is that, like, the reality? It's just, where is the Palestinian state? Why can't they accept aid? Why can't they accept solidarity? So that's, the first ship that I went with, or we attempted to go, in April of 2024, we had, I think it was, it's been so long now since I spoke about this, but I think it was 3,500, like, pounds or tons of aid. We had crutches, we had ambulances, we had baby formula, food, we had everything. It was a massive, like, cargo ship. We actually had a few ships that we were planning on going all together, so that was, you know, if we could have been able to do that and deliver this life-saving humanitarian aid, that would have been incredible. But the second goal, I think, especially as an American, is, you know, maybe in some small part, in some small way, especially to the Palestinians, like, demonstrating that most Americans don't support this, and our government is rogue. They're genocidal. They just are the antithesis of humanity, of life, of any of this. And there's so many Americans that don't support this. So I felt like me as an American with American citizenship, like, and my privilege, that I should put my body on the line and, you know, stand up for Palestine in that way.
Right. And the lessons that you learned from that experience?
The lessons, you know, it was heartbreaking, actually. It was devastating to see kind of, you know, the good of all the people from all over the world. People from over 100 countries came to Istanbul for that mission. And people, you know, put so much on the line, like, you know, relationships with family, friends. They put up their own money, maybe they lost their jobs. We all tried to do this one thing, all these hundreds of people coming together. And even with all of that, just this one criminal state could mobilize its, you know, criminal network, axis of evil, to stop us, to stop civilians and just people of the world that want to do good. So that was a devastating lesson in that, you know, where is the good in this world?
Well, earlier today I was looking at some photos and saw a photo of you as the RN on a hunger strike for Gaza.
Yeah.
Tell me about that experience. What motivated you?
Yeah.
And how did it go?
So, as I mentioned, like, after the crushing just bureaucratic warfare that we experienced in Istanbul, I had the opportunity to go to Palestine afterwards. And, you know, I actually learned about Palestine over 10 years ago at this point, and learned about Gaza, and it was just I couldn't believe that this was happening. And I was just like, how did I not learn about this before? And how is the world allowing this to happen? So it wasn't that I didn't know what was happening in Palestine. I knew about the apartheid, the occupation, all of those things, but when I went to Palestine and saw it with my own eyes, and just saw the reality of the brutal occupation and just the suffering of the Palestinian people for no reason other than just, you know, disgusting U.S. Israeli NATO imperialism, it was really shocking to me, even though I knew about it before. Seeing it in person was another experience. So I felt so much guilt being there as an American. And Palestinians, I often had many conversations with Palestinians, and they would always say, I would hear a lot, like, can you tell the Americans, like, we don't wish them any harm, like, why are they doing this to us, like, and just the guilt of being there, and I just made the decision in my head, like, I don't have much power as, like, one person, as one individual, and, like, what more can I do to, like, amplify just the voice of the Palestinian struggle, and that's kind of what I came up with. I was like, I'm just going to do a hunger strike in front of the White House, and even though people are telling me, like, it's stupid, you're not going to, like, you think you're going to change anything, da-da-da-da-da, I'm like, I don't even care, like, what's the alternative? Just, like, sitting at home and crying, like, at least,
but
like, do something.
Going back in time, would you still do that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually did a second hunger strike with, like, in solidarity with a group in Jordan. Actually, I'm close friends with a lot of activists in Jordan, and we organized, like, a global hunger strike, so I helped with that and did the hunger strike again. It's tough. I'm not saying that it's not, but it's nothing compared to what people are going through in Gaza.
You're right on that,
mm-hmm.
Yes, of course. How do you respond to criticism of your support for Palestine?
You know, I don't even care anymore. There was a point I've dealt with harassment and getting fired and death threats and people trying to get my licenses.
Death threats.
Yeah, like, and my licenses revoked as a nurse or a nurse practitioner, and just, you know, I've lost relationships with friends. I mean, I wouldn't call them friends anymore at this point, or, like, family members over my stance, and it's just, like, I know that I'm doing the right thing, so I can't really pay too much mind to the criticism, because at this point, like, anyone defending this anymore is just, like, not worth having an opinion to me on anything, to be honest.
Right, and aside from family and friends,
yeah.
Of course, there must have been, as you said, professional repercussions,
yeah.
Because of your stances. How did you handle those?
Yeah, I mean, especially in New York, the healthcare, I don't know, hospitals in New York and the healthcare system, it's pretty Zionist. So when I started to become more outspoken in October of 2023 about this live stream slaughter I was witnessing, I just, you know, I realized, well, I'm probably going to get fired for this at some point, but that was a decision that I made, that I willingly made, because what would be the alternative? Just being quiet? Like, I wouldn't be able to live with myself, so that's kind of just, I always just try to put things in the bigger perspective of, yeah, like, maybe I'm facing some consequences, you know, standing with the oppressed, especially, like, going against the dominant, like, U.S. hegemony on this issue, like, you're going to face consequences, of course, but it always just comes back to, like, what's right and what's wrong, and that's a very simple answer for me.
Jennifer Koenigs, it was a pleasure to talk to you and
yeah.
Have you here on Soul.
Thank you.
And thank you for spending the time with us again on another Soul. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, back on the road.
welcome, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. After that, we have Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions about children and adolescents and their upbringing. Israel Watch will follow next. The program aims to examine and criticize reports and analysis by Israeli media on current events and issues in West Asia region. And the Ocean of Dua is our final program this hour. The program gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamil al-Ziyarat. Stay with us for the next hour.
Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhal muzammil qum al-layla illa qalila nusahu aw inqus minhu qalila aw zid 'alayhi wa rattil al-Qur'ana tartila.
Let's recite the Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. I'm happy to be with you.
Thank you, brother. Well, the audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of three main parts. First, brother Muhammad is going to talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. Then we are going to listen to a recitation recited by a famous reciter of the Holy Quran. And after it, Brother Muhammad will analyze that recitation. So the audience, please stay tuned. Well, as always, in the first part, dear audience, we are going to talk about the music of the Noble Quran. Well, in the previous episode, Brother Muhammad, talking about the music of the Noble Quran, you said that the rhythm and the rhyme, and in general, the arrangement of the words of the Noble Quran has made it easy for us to understand and memorize it. Now we are here to listen to some other aspects of the music of the Noble Quran.
Okay, today we're going to talk about the role of the fawasil of the ayat, the intervals of the verses. Why are we saying interval? Interval is actually a word that we're using instead of rhyme. Because you would usually use the word rhyme when you're talking about poetry. But the Quran is beyond poetry. It's not just something that has an outward appearance and does not contain very useful and beneficial meanings, and just in general, you know, things that are very good for us to know. Some poems, they're just like, they don't have that much, they don't have as much things to say as the Quran. The Quran is a lot deeper.
Of course, nothing has such things to say.
So we should not compare. That is why we shouldn't compare the Quran with poetry. So we're going to say interval. And these intervals, they come at the end of every verse. Okay? And this is what creates the beauty and the music of the Quran. Because, for example...
Actually, one of the things that makes the Quran beautiful.
Yeah. not the only thing. It's one of the things that makes the Quran so beautiful and makes it a part of the music of the Quran. Just the rhyme, you know, because just the example of poetry. Of course, we shouldn't compare the Quran to poetry, but whenever you listen to a poem, just the order and the harmony that exists, the rhyme, it catches our attention. And there are different literary devices that are used in poetry. And in this, from this aspect, we could say that the Quran is similar to poetry, but it is a lot better.
Yes.
And a very higher level in terms of, you know, the literary devices, the rhyme, just the beauty, the effect that it has on one's soul and heart. And
interesting.
For example, let's talk about Surah Taha. Surah Taha has one of the most beautiful rhymes among the surahs of the Quran. And there are like different sets of rhymes, okay?
Or better to say,
intervals. Yeah, sets of intervals. So, for example, at the beginning we have Taha, ma anzalna alayka al-Qur'an litashqa illa tadhkiratan liman yakhsha tanzilan mimman khalaqa al-ardha was-samawati al-ula. As you can see, at the end of all of the beginning verses of this surah, we have alif al-mad. Istawa al-thara wa akhfa al-husna Musa. And this makes it really beautiful. And so this is the story of Prophet Moses. First, at the beginning, we have how the Quran praises. The Quran here is addressing the Prophet, because Taha is one of the names of Prophet Muhammad. Allah is saying, "We did not reveal the Quran to make it difficult for you, to cause you trouble. It's just a reminder for those who are God-wary." And then the Quran says, "Wahal ataka hadithu Musa." That's where the story of Moses, Prophet Moses, begins. So Allah tells the story of Prophet Moses, and also the conversation that takes place between Prophet Musa and Allah. It's interesting that at the end of all of these conversations, at the end of every line, of every sentence, we have this interval, this rhyme. Even in places where God is, like at the end, he says, "Ya Musa." That makes it really beautiful. "Wama tilka biyaminika, ya Musa." Or verse 40, we have this long verse, and at the end we have "Ala qadari ya Musa." This "ya Musa" makes it very beautiful, because Allah is like, you know, he is emphasizing this "ya Musa" in a very affectionate way, that he wants to, you know, he wants to console his prophet, by saying, it's repeating, "Oh Moses, oh Moses, dear Moses," like that.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. The audience, stay with us. We're going to be right back. Audience of IRIB English Radio, in the second part of the program, let's recite the Quran. We're going to listen to the recitation of Surah Az-Zumar, verses 65 to 68, recited by Sheikh Juma Mukhtar. Let's enjoy it.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد أوحي إليك وإلى الذين من قبلك لئن أشركت
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, you're listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran. And what you just listened to was recitation of Surah Az-Zumar, verses 65 to 68, recited by Sheikh Jum'a Mukhtar. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's analyze this recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This was a very good recitation by Sheikh Jum'a Mukhtar. And this was entirely in Maqam Ar-Rast, a very beautiful Maqam. It's, we could say that it's an upright Maqam. That's what Rast means, actually.
Yeah,
Rast.
The meaning conveys this concept.
It's a very, it has a very powerful effect on the listener. And at the same time, it's very enjoyable. And because of this powerful effect that it has, it's good to use this maqam in for verses that talk about really extremely important matters, important subjects. Okay, for example, in the verse that Sheikh Mukhtar is reciting, verse 65 of Surah Az-Zumar, it's about وَلَقَدْ أُوحِيَ إِلَيْكَ وَإِلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكَ لَئِنْ أَشْرَكْتَ لَيَحْبَطَنَّ عَمَلُكَ وَلَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْخَاسِرِينَ. It's Allah saying that we have revealed to you, Allah says, I have revealed to you and those before you that if you ascribe partners to me, that is Allah, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you ascribe partners to Allah, to
right.
God, you do polytheism, because that's what it means. Shirk means polytheism, to take more gods other than Allah and say that they're also Sharik, they have a part, and they're partners of Allah. So, لَيَحْبَطَنَّ عَمَّلُكَ وَلَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْفَقْ. All of your deeds will be nullified. All your good deeds will be nullified, and you'll be among the losers. Shirk is the only sin that will not be forgiven. Okay? So if someone has shirk and does every good thing, he helps the poor, he builds.